Iran's presence in the Qatari Emir emphasized the need for expanding bilateral ties in various fields. Palestinians pay tribute to veteran journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed by Israeli occupation forces while reporting an army raid. And official data shows the risk of a recession in Britain is gathering pace as the country's economy shrinks in March.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Iran's president and the Qatari emir underscore the need for the expansion of ties between the two countries in various fields.
During our talks with the Qatari emir, we underscored the need for the expansion of ties between Iran and Qatar in political, economic, commercial, and cultural fields, as well as in tourism and energy sectors. It was emphasized that the two countries work for joint investments.
President Raisi made the remarks following his meeting with Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Speaking at a joint press conference, the two heads of state called for just and comprehensive solutions to the current regional issues, especially in Palestine and Yemen. They condemned the Israeli killing of Al Jazeera's journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. President Raisi said committing such crimes will not bring security for the occupying regime, but will stir up hatred toward Israel. Qatar's emir also called for justice for the perpetrators. Sheikh Tamim is on a one-day visit to Tehran at the head of a high-ranking political and economic delegation. The two sides have signed several cooperation deals. Political analyst Sahmat Titorabi joined us earlier with his take on the Iran-Qatar ties. He believes that Qatar is after a strategic relationship with Iran, since Doha pursues a more independent policy than other Persian Gulf Arab states.
What we see in this relationship between Qatar and Iran is very interesting in the sense that Qatar was, for a period, trying to develop an independent policy from the other states in the southern Persian Gulf, such as Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, and it was immediately sanctioned and cut off from everything by Qatar's so-called Arab brothers. And the one country that actually came to its rescue was Iran. Qatar is trying to have a more of an independent policy vis-a-vis the other countries, other Arab countries, the ones that did the Abraham Accords and so on. But still, it's under pressure. There's only so much that the Qataris can do before, the Americans and the Saudis put pressure on them. This is why it's important for Qatar to have a strategic relationship with Iran, because for Qatar, it allows it to balance the pressure that it's feeling from the other one. And of course, for Iran, it's good in the sense that it shows that they always try to have this kind of united front, the countries of the southern Persian Gulf, against Iran. But the reality is very different. Each one of them has its own interest with Iran. But the Saudis and the Americans always want to kind of, browbeat the smaller nations into complying with their hostility with Iran, which is against the interest of those countries, such as Qatar or Kuwait or even the Emirates.
Well, the breaking news concerns the meeting that has taken place at this point between the Emir of Qatar and Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei here in the capital, Tehran. On a one-day visit, the Emir of Qatar has already met with Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, and now he has met with Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei. Thousands of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank attend a procession and memorial service for journalists Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed by Israeli forces one day earlier. At the ceremony, President Mahmoud Abbas said that Israel was fully responsible for Abu Akleh's death. He rejected the notion of a joint investigation with Israel and said Palestinian officials would go to the International Criminal Court to seek justice. Abu Akleh's funeral is scheduled for Friday. Her killing has sparked an outpouring of condolences and condemnations, as well as calls for a thorough investigation to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Israeli forces have killed a renowned international journalist in the occupied West Bank. Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akleh was shot dead on Wednesday. She was killed while reporting on an Israeli raid against Palestinians in the city of Jenin. Violence has surged in Jenin in recent weeks as Israeli forces have stepped up operations in the area after a spate of deadly retaliatory attacks targeting Israelis. Abu Akleh was a very well-respected journalist who has been working with Al Jazeera since the beginning of the Second Palestinian Intifada in 2000.
And the shooting of this journalist is just to cover up their crimes, to show what they were to not allow the people of the world to see the kinds of things they were doing with this raid in Jenin and many other instances. They didn't only kill this journalist, but they wounded a second journalist.
The Palestinian Health Ministry also said another journalist sustained a gunshot wound to the back. The Associated Press said the Palestinian journalist working for the Al-Quds newspaper was in stable condition. The International Federation of Journalists has described the killing as a deliberate, systematic targeting of a journalist and is planning to submit the case to the International Criminal Court. Yet again, journalists wearing press vests clearly identified were targeted by Israeli snipers. We will seek to add this case to the ICC complaint submitted by the IFJ detailing such systematic targeting. And the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate has decried Abu Akleh's death as a clear assassination perpetrated by the Israeli occupation army.
And they killed this journalist, Shireen Abu Akleh, by shooting her in the face. That's just a terrible thing to do. They didn't have to do anything like that. It's a brutal way of acting. It doesn't give any show any care to human life. It is a very a terrible thing, and it needs to be condemned by the whole world.
Iran has also harshly condemned the killing, saying the case highlights Israel's brutal treatment towards journalists and media outlets.
This is not the first time that a Palestinian reporter has been killed by Israeli forces. During the March of Return protests that were held in 2018 and 19, Palestinian journalists were regularly targeted to prevent them from reporting the Israeli gunfire toward fellow Palestinians. Time and time again, Israeli forces have killed Palestinian civilians, including journalists and medics, without cause, and they do that with impunity, as if they were above international law.
Meanwhile, a Qatari official has harshly lashed out at Israel over the incident, calling for an end to, quote, state-sponsored Israeli terrorism. The Palestinian resistance group Hamas condemned in the strongest terms what it called the premeditated murder. It said the world and all international institutions must condemn the heinous crime against the press and free speech and hold the Israeli regime accountable. It further noted that this crime will not succeed in preventing the role of the media and free journalists in conveying the truth, the reality of the Israeli occupation, its brutality, terrorism, and the crimes against the Palestinian people, land, and holy sites.
There's going to be a lot of anger among Palestinians, and there will be more conflict and more fighting because of it, and there will probably be some resistance that will be met very harshly by Israel, which is financed to a large extent and given a lot of military aid by the United States. So they have weapons that Palestinians can't in any way match.
Yet Israel has another belief on what has occurred. The Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, has said, according to the information we have gathered, it appears likely that armed Palestinians who were firing indiscriminately at the time were responsible for the unfortunate death of the journalist. In a statement, Al Jazeera called on the international community to hold Israeli forces accountable for the intentional targeting and killing of its journalist.
But it's not the only thing. There is right now a case that has been filed with the International Criminal Court against Israel for the shooting of four journalists in this past year alone. And Israel has actually shot 46 journalists since the year 2000. So this is just the continuation of a brutal policy.
This is not the first time Israel has killed a journalist. The regime systematically targets Palestinian journalists, and with the deliberate killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, Israel has now killed over 45 Palestinian journalists since the year 2000.
Israel has approved the construction of over 4,000 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. The Peace Now anti-settlement group announced the figure. The regime gave the final go-ahead to the construction of over 2,700 units. Some 1,600 units also received an initial nod. Meanwhile, the Palestine Liberation Organization condemned the new Israeli approval, urging Palestinians to step up resistance in the face of Israeli settlement expansion. The PLO called for action to compel the regime to stop expanding settlements. The new Israeli project is the biggest since U.S. President Joe Biden took office. All the Israeli settlements are illegal within the bounds of international law. Lebanon is preparing for landmark elections amid political rifts in the country. Resistance movement Hezbollah says that it has focused on a plan to rebuild and reform the state, while its foes only seek to marginalize and disarm the group. Mariam Saleh has more from Beirut.
As Lebanon makes the final preparations and logistics for pivotal parliamentary elections, the political polarization in the country is growing more evident. In a Hezbollah elections rally, the resistance movement's leader called people to choose between those who want a strong Lebanon, capable of exploiting its own natural resources, and those who only seek alms and keep Lebanon in debt.
You need to make a choice and decide if you want the side that wants Lebanon to be truly free, sovereign, independent, its own master, and strong, not only in Lebanon, but in the region as well. Or do you want the side that wants Lebanon to be weak and frail, begging at the doors of embassies and tents? This is the question that you, as Lebanese people, need to answer on May the 15th. As for the people of the resistance, you have sacrificed for the dignity and freedom of Lebanon, and I heard your chants today, and we know who you will vote for.
A stark ally of Saudi Arabia and the United States is the Lebanese Forces Party, headed by Samir Jaja. The main slogan in their electoral campaign is that the resistance is behind the current collapse, and the elections are meant to disarm and isolate it. Some members of the Lebanese parliament believe the elections are one main battle, which will not change much in the rhetoric of the anti-resistance groups.
We are doing everything possible to maintain the sovereignty, the steadfastness, the independence of our domestic decision. The problem is with the others who are being dictated by the United States, by Saudi Arabia, and by others. We're not afraid, or our people are not afraid. We're afraid about the country of their always maneuverish and, if you want, amateurish conduct in the political level.
The 2022 elections are scheduled for May 15th as the country grapples with its worst economic crisis and Western limitations on the country in attaining investments. Hezbollah says the campaign by Western-backed political groups has not stopped Hezbollah and its allies from declaring electoral programs which contain tangible work plans to help resolve the socio-economic crisis while they continue to defend the country from Israeli threats. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The EU warns any move by Britain to unilaterally ignore post-Brexit trade arrangements in Northern Ireland would be unacceptable. The warning comes after the UK Foreign Secretary said that London will have no choice but to act if the EU does not show enough flexibility. Britain has suggested that it would be lawful to override parts of the arrangements that allow goods to go from Britain to Northern Ireland. The EU has warned that it could retaliate by introducing trade sanctions. The trade arrangements, known as the Northern Ireland Protocol, have been a contentious element of the Brexit Treaty, signed by Britain and the EU in December 2020. The arrangements were designed to avoid the need for a hard border with the Irish Republic, which remains part of the European Union. Britain's economy is teetering on the brink of a recession amid soaring inflation. The country's official data shows the economy has contracted by 0.1% in March, following a zero growth in February. The UK economy also grew 0.8% overall in the first 3 months of the year. The country's finance minister blames repercussions of the Ukraine war as well as other global issues for the current circumstances in the UK. Meanwhile, the Bank of England has forecast that inflation could rise more than 10% by the end of the year. Experts say the price pressures will probably mean the bank will raise interest rates further to curb inflation. But still, the major source of concern for Britain's economy is the risk of a recession. A new poll shows that the average French person's life is being drastically impacted by runaway inflation. Coming after years of far-right economic austerity, the French economy now appears on the brink of major trouble. Romy Mazzari has more from Paris.
France is a nation of 67 million people, and 40 million of them earn less than 2,000 euros per month. A new poll reveals that skyrocketing inflation is wreaking unprecedented havoc on their lives. The poll says that after bills are paid, 20 million Frenchmen have less than 100 euros in the bank by the 10th of each month. It's not a new problem. Perhaps the primary slogan of the Yellow Vest movement has been a cry of the end of the month.
For us delivery drivers, the price of gas has put us in a very difficult condition. I spent almost 60% more on petrol than I used to, and every day now. Of course, it's not just petrol. Everything else has gotten more expensive, too. The state has to lower taxes.
A stunning 95% of those earning less than 2,000 euros per month are worried about inflation. Two-thirds say they are struggling to get by. Half say they have insomnia over financial worries. And 80% of households with children fear they will fall into poverty.
Everything is more expensive, and all my friends and I talk about it. Even the cost of something basic, like cooking oil, has gotten dramatically more expensive. We hope things will somehow get better, but for now, things are quite tight.
New official data says prices will jump 5.4% in June, in the largest monthly increase since 1985. The next 2 months will also see further increases, and combined with near-recession levels of economic growth. After years of no-strings-attached quantitative easing and zero-interest rate policies for the rich, interest rates are now being hiked just when the average person most needs some credit. The failure to invest years of this so-called free money into societally productive investments means the real economy has suffered from long-running neglect at the expense of high finance, real estate, and stocks. Deeply unpopular austerity cuts have also worsened the condition of the real economy, put even more costs on the average person's back, and left France poorly equipped for what seems like the latest Western financial crisis. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Russia says Finland's bid to join NATO threatens its security. Moscow has vowed retaliation in that case. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said NATO's expansion does not make Europe more stable and secure. He said the move will prompt a corresponding symmetrical response from Moscow. Earlier today, Finland said that it will apply for NATO membership without delay. The Finnish president said the national steps needed to enact that decision will be taken rapidly over the next few days. Sweden is also likely to follow suit. Sources inside the EU say that NATO allies are expecting Finland and Sweden to be granted membership quickly. Russia has repeatedly warned the two European Union member states against the bid. Moscow sees NATO's expansion as a direct threat to its own security.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump holds rally to endorse a celebrity doctor ahead of Republican Senate primary in Pennsylvania, which will have big consequences for this November's election. We have prepared for you an article written by Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled, Dr. Oz Embraced Trump's Big Lie. Will MAGA voters reward him in Senate race? Whether Pennsylvanian conservatives go along with the endorsement when the primary race is held on 17th of May will have big consequences, not merely on Donald Trump's record of advancing his chosen people and with it his grip on the Republican Party. It will also have ramifications for this November's election, which, in tune with recent contests in the state, is almost certain to be nail-bitingly close and could be critical in determining whether the Republicans retake the U.S. Senate. The trouble is, many Trump supporters don't know what to make of Mehmet Oz, the celebrity television surgeon better known as Dr. Oz. The phenomena was vividly illustrated after the 6th of January insurrection at the U.S. Capitol last year. Republican leaders, including Kevin McCarthy, were at first critical of Donald Trump's role, but then began faithfully repeating his big lie that the election had been stolen from him. More recently, J.D. Vance, the venture capitalist author of Hillbilly Elegy, ditched his earlier criticism of Donald Trump in order to win the former president's endorsement in the race for a U.S. Senate seat in Ohio. The humiliating gambit paid off recently, with Vance sealing the Republican primary, having received a bounce from Donald Trump's backing. Of all the many examples of this form, there has rarely been as dramatic a shedding of fact-based reasoning in exchange for Donald Trump's universe of alternative facts than that displayed by Dr. Oz. He has descended from the scientific heights of a renowned cardiothoracic surgeon down through his promotion of quack remedies in his daytime television show and into a full MAGA embrace of the Trump big lie. Dr. Oz, a 61-year-old, has an impeccable medical background. Born in Cleveland, Ohio, he is the son of Turkish immigrants and followed his father into cardiothoracic surgery, with Ivy League training at Harvard University and the University of Pennsylvania. At his peak, he was an innovator in minimally invasive heart surgery. At Columbia University, when he treated patients until 2018, he authored numerous peer-reviewed papers bearing impenetrable sentences like this one. In the multivariate Cox proportional hazards regression analysis, CPB time, previous cardiac surgery, sternal wound infection, post-operative renal failure, and post-operative stroke were all associated with increased risk of mortality following MICS. His weakness, or strength, was the allure of fame and fortune. In 1996, he performed a heart transplant on the brother of the New York Yankees manager in the middle of a World Series, which the Yankees won. Such extraordinary serendipity turned him into a media darling. Oprah Winfrey came calling, dubbing him America's Doctor. And the end result was the Dr. Oz Show, which ran until this January. His show included public service broadcasting, bringing attention to type 2 diabetes and encouraging his viewers to eat more healthily. But over time, he slid into controversial territory. By 2014, he was being called a snake oil peddler and hauled before a U.S. Senate committee for touting miracle diet products on the Dr. Oz Show. During the pandemic, he championed several of the same discredited pseudoscience treatments, such as hydroxychloroquine, pushed by Donald Trump. To complete the decline, the cardiothoracic surgeon has now incorporated into his Pennsylvania Senate campaign the falsehood that the 2020 presidential election that Donald Trump lost was riddled with fraud. He said at a recent televised debate for the Republican primary, "I have discussed it with President Trump and we cannot move on. We have to be serious about what happened in 2020. There is no evidence that fraud on a significant scale occurred in the 2020 presidential election in Pennsylvania or anywhere else in the United States." The problem with being a daytime television host is that you leave a very long paper trail. Dr. Oz's rivals for the Republican nomination have been bombarding Pennsylvania voters with attack advertisements portraying him as a Hollywood liberal and a rhino, Republican in name only. Among the inconvenient truths that the adverts regurgitate is the time that Dr. Oz invited Michelle Obama onto his show, his reflections on systemic racism and how it leads to disparities in health outcomes, and his discussions on how to reduce deaths and injuries from guns. The attack advertisements have featured a 2019 interview in which he questioned Republican states that were introducing bills to ban abortion at 6 weeks, known as heartbeat pills. The downpour of negative political adverts carrying politically awkward clips from the Dr. Oz show has clearly had an impact on the race. Latest opinion polls show the Republican primary race is too close to call, with the television personality in a slim lead on 18% to the 16% of his main rival, the super wealthy former hedge fund chief executive officer David McCormick. By contrast, the Democratic field of candidates appears to be already settled with a clear front-runner, Pennsylvania's Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman. He's a champion of labor unions, legalized marijuana and combating inequalities in income, health and housing. Sharon Nagle, a 60-year-old, a bartender from a small coal mining town, said she was troubled by Dr. Oz's dual U.S.-Turkish citizenship. The issue has also been seized upon by Dr. Oz's Republican rivals, who have called his Turkish ties a national security risk, forcing him to promise to renounce his Turkish citizenship should he win the Senate seat. Sharon Nagle also objects to Dr. Oz's Muslim identity. Political strategists at the rally worked extra hard to try and overcome the chilly response to the Dr. Oz endorsement. J.D. Vance was rolled out on stage with a clear hope that the victory he pulled out of the hat last week might somehow rub off on Dr. Oz. The crowd was assailed through the evening with 30-second videos attempting to debunk the portrayal of the candidate given in the attack advertisements. Here was Dr. Oz surrounded by children insisting life begins at conception. Here was Dr. Oz dressed in a shirt brandishing a double-barreled shotgun. How could this man be against the Second Amendment? When Dr. Oz finally addressed the crowd, he reassured them that he was one of them, a genuine MAGA man. He said, "The president endorsed me as an America First candidate. President Trump endorsed me because I am smart, I am tough, and I will never let you down." Then Donald Trump himself bigged up his chosen candidate. Paying lip service to his followers' misgivings, he said, "We endorse a lot of people, a little out of the box." He reminded the crowd how Dr. Oz had invited him onto his show in 2016, giving the then presidential hopeful a great bill of health through telling him to lose a few pounds. Trump claimed Dr. Oz has had an enormously successful career on television and now he's running to save our country from the radical lunatics.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Maipal Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Maurice McLeod, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organization Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and a corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system which sent speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media, embedded behind police lines, portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
And first of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that there are two different versions of this film, and I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking, the rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking and that it was done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on the fly and, you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially-minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version, and we didn't get those. What it has, and what really is its strength, is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something, and in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine, but they're all big, epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of process that you and your friends could organize, mm-hmm. or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in, and that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protest firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest. Mm.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, it was very bitty, but that was its nature and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd been a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I felt there could have been a little bit more to show how they were to how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, at the end of the Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So it was, you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of you were plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay. You know,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
That was intentional.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, you know, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for the need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on, there's a quote where one of the protesters says, you know, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learned that they've just been named European City of Culture. Mm-hmm. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. what we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with Mike said? And do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, you know, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about, you know, our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but you know, most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. There's a lot in that. There's a lot in let's get our own messages across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of the film, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. Mm-hmm. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming mm-hmm. over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonise the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. Mm-hmm. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack, and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protested and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, connected mm-hmm. to the people next to you. And that really came across. It didn't feel at all, and I don't think it needs to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It's like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing, and that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, I mean, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way the authorities deal with what could be, you know, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. They're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. Mm. Mm-hmm. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, to maybe in the interactive part this happens somewhere. It'd been nice to have seen more from the police, because I was there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to was trying to converse with a police officer, and he says, "Take your helmet off, yes. Come and talk to us."
I'd
like to have seen more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area. I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that one of their fellow citizens, and think, "No, you're violent, and I'm going to hit you." How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, this is a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest. And sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, actions and reactions, like we've just said. Mm-hmm. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, "Yeah, violence, of course this should happen." It said, "What's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back, and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting, quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
No, very clever.
It opens them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white, it's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kangler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan "Gotovisa," they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had an impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We were talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph, it is more of a sort of score draw that sort of they muddle through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learnt in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
And Maurice, what did you think of this sort of ending towards of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Mm-hmm. Maybe their goals were too short term, changing a mayor and removing the radar cameras. And that
some of it seems a bit superficial. Some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film therefore has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that they, as the woman was saying there, they've replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. But I felt that the documentary did mention this, that that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. Mm-hmm. There was someone talking about the social, the community type changes that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involved. Someone's talking about family history that they started discussing since the protest. So I think that sort of stuff often gets ignored. You go, did you win or did you not win? You've something just in coming together is important.
It's about, you know, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. And I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here.
Yeah. And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially in a time like now, this political climate where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protests? I don't know. I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the documentary is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen? All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and it made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor, and no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from, you know, clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff, clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much of it still felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, I know, the anatomy of a protest, or, you know, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
That's interesting. So it's open to interpretation and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.